The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. We have kind of a special Q&A edition today. We've got a special guest, which makes the show special. We've, of course, got Jim, who's going to join us in a moment. But more importantly, we have one of our tax team members, Paul, one of the CPAs that does work with us here. We've got him in today, and I think we warned people that that was going to happen, and we were going to focus today on answering some tax-related questions. So welcome, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I think this is the first time I've ever been called a taxateer. You know, that I've never been.
That's Jim's new deal. Yeah, Jim's and Jim Salnier and the taxateers. Sounds like a terrible folk group from the 1960s or something. But anyway, he's very proud of that, the taxateers. And we have three currently, so I guess it is fairly appropriate for a creation of Jim's.
So, except the three musketeers are actually four. So
that's right.
It's just sort of weird how that name came about.
Yeah, that is odd. So Jim, one of the taxateers, is here. So you can join us when you unmute your microphone. And he's joining us remotely from his recording studio. Paul is in the studio with me, so audio might sound a little bit different from... Normally, I'm in here all by myself. It's kind of nice to have it old school with someone else in here. So he elected to join me instead of being in the penthouse suite that Jim usually records in, which is separate. So I think Jim's the one with the question, so he's going to have to field it. He's not unmuting, so I'm guessing something.
Okay, there. Sorry about that. I'm unmuted.
There he is. Okay.
I had to go get a pillow. I sit on a wooden chair, folks. And it's much more comfortable with a pillow between the wooden chair and my rear end. So I had to go get a pillow.
That might be one of the first signs of aging.
Is it one of those special donut-shaped pillows?
No, I didn't even know there's donut-shaped pillows.
Yeah. I don't use one, but it's a thing, apparently.
It's for sitting on?
Well, yeah. It takes some pressure off of your tailbone.
Oh. No, I'll have to look into that. I'll look on Amazon for a donut-shaped pillow. Okay. I didn't realize there was such a thing.
Well, welcome. Okay. I'm glad you found your pillow so we can start the show.
Okay, but everybody, welcome. This is a special Q&A session of the Retirement and IRA Show for tax questions. We did get several tax questions that we will answer. Unlike when I do it with Chris, I'm kind to our guests, so I sent Paul the questions ahead of time. I don't know, Paul, if we will get through all of them. You're a longtime podcast listener. We'll have you chat a little bit to our listeners, and you can tell them whatever it is you want them to know about you if you so desire. But you know, Chris doesn't get the pleasure of getting the questions ahead of time, but I like people who I want to come back again and again. I don't mind sending them the questions first.
Especially when you're dealing with taxes, it can be helpful to know exactly what the questions are. Sometimes you, as you mentioned, Jim, many times you can go down a rabbit hole, and that's definitely true with taxes.
Oh, absolutely. And you probably know, as a longtime podcast listener, that Chris is known to do that. Mm-hmm. And he can sometimes, go on and on and on. It gets annoying after a while.
I'll try to contain myself today since we have a special guest.
Thank you. All righty. So with that said, Paul, why don't you say hi to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm as you probably mentioned, I'm a longtime listener to the podcast. Every once in a while, I do send in a question or a comment. I live south of where your office is in Fort Collins. And for a lot of the listeners out there, they may not know that Colorado has a new tourist attraction, and that's called Buc-ee's. If people have ever been to a Buc-ee's, it's a 75,000 square foot convenience store with about 125 filling stations or ways to gas up your pump. So that's not too far south from here. And I have to stop by on the way home because my son's already given me a Buc-ee list.
Buc-ee's. Chris, have you been to Buc-ee's? I have not.
No, I'm going to wait till the excitement wears off a little bit because I've heard it's just super, super crowded. So I'm going to hold off. I have been to a Buc-ee's before down in Texas, the home of Buc-ee's. Yeah. But it'll be a while before I make it to the Colorado one.
And the Texas Buc-ee's are actually upset because the Colorado Buc-ee's is the largest in the country, and Texas doesn't like that. So they're going to have one that's 1,000 square foot larger pretty soon.
Those Texans, man, they don't like anything if they're not the biggest and the best at it. Too bad their football teams don't like that. But anyways, that's another whole story. I have not been to Buc-ee's, never even heard of a damn Buc-ee's until I was in Kentucky last year. And on the way back from the Pinnacles, which is in Berea, the group I was with were trying to be nice to me, and they said they were going to take me to a Buc-ee's. And when they explained to me it was just a gas station and convenience store, I just told them, I said, oh, I'm not trying to be rude, but I don't need to stop at a gas station and a convenience store. But now I see it's, I guess, something much bigger than that. But still, you did go over your Buc-ee list from your son. I got to say, it does not sound like a location where I would be able to get the type of food that I normally like to eat, which tends to be a little on the healthy side.
I'm not sure if any of that's in a Buc-ee's. I'm not totally sure about that.
I think you like barbecue, though. They have good barbecue in there.
Yeah.
But you can't get like a salad? Do they have salads?
They might have something green there off to the side.
something green, like green what?
M&M's.
Green donuts. Yeah.
Green
M&M's. Green M&M's. Green hot dogs.
I'm sure they've got a leaf or two in there somewhere.
It's probably what they're feeding the rabbits before they butcher them and turn them into something too. But anyways, maybe I will stop by the Buc-ee's at some point in time. But like you, Chris, I no desire to deal with thousands of people cramming into a convenience store. Okay, folks. So this podcast today, and we hope to make it a reoccurring event when we have one of the three taxateers on. I'm not quite sure if Steve and Alan will come on, our other two CPAs. I think a lot might ride on how Paul does and if they feel they want to be subjected to the same wonderful experience or horrendous experience. Paul will have to let us know how he feels after this. But going forward, we do hope to get one of the CPAs on, hopefully once a month if everything worked out great. But on a semi-regular basis, we hope to get our CPAs on answering your tax-related questions. So if you have tax questions, it is helpful from this point forward. We started talking about this over the past couple of weeks. Kind of put in your subject line when you email your questions, and you email them to jim@jimhelps.com. When you do send out the emails, put in the subject line now kind of what the topic is, especially if it's an IRMA or a Social Security question or an annuity question or an IRA question and now a tax question. Because I've now created little subfolders in my computer and I'm just dragging them into there So if I want to get a specific question on a specific topic, it's easier for me to find. It's a new thing I'm trying. I have no idea how it's going to work, but that's my intent. So it will be helpful if people do that. And when I made that announcement a couple of weeks ago, Paul, we did get some tax questions, as you see, because you have them. Chris, you don't have them, but that's okay. You're so used to this. So
I'm not on the hot seat today. That's going to be Paul. So,
you still are on the hot seat because everybody has given state hints. And since Paul has the email questions in front of him, it's kind of not fair if I pit him against you. So you're still on your own on your state hint.
Okay.
So this first question I thought is pretty easy. It's like a softball question to you, Paul, just to kind of break you in. And Chris, he begins by saying, I'm from the state with a rock that looks like a haystack.
Hmm. I know that. And well, you said Paul already knows because he has the question, but would you like me to go first?
Well, I just noticed he didn't give the answer. Paul, you have this question in front of you. Am I misreading it? I don't see the state listed in here anywhere.
Well, I'm glad I'm here then.
So I have no idea if what you're about to say is right. Folks, if you're going to give a hint, it helps me if you give the answer as well. I have no idea. But Paul, since the answer's not here, do you want to gander a guess?
Well, I think I've been to it, and that's in the state of Oregon. There's a haystack. Actually, I think it's even a state park in Oregon, on the Oregon coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At Cannon Beach.
Chris, what were you going to say?
Cannon Beach, Oregon is where that is. So yeah. I agree with Paul. It's got to be Oregon. It's not only shaped like a haystack, but it's called Haystack Rock.
Yeah, okay. Well, I never heard of that, but okay. But yeah, folks, helps to have the answer as well. All right. They begin, and this is a woman, so we will call her Georgette. I have what I believe is a simple question for you to answer, but it has me chasing my tail. We are not yet retired, but we hope to soon. When I use a tax estimator to calculate how much we will owe on IRA withdrawals, it appears we are being taxed on our taxes, which is contrary to my belief that we should not be doubled taxed. Maybe that belief of mine is just incorrect. Let me give you a simple example, she says. If I put into the tax estimator calculator a withdrawal amount of $100,000, which is the amount needed to cover our expenses, my tax estimator says we owe $8,236. So my thought is that we should be able to withdraw $108,236 from my IRA and withhold the $8,236. But when I plug that into my calculator, it says I owe an additional $989 in taxes. So in my opinion, I'm essentially being taxed on the additional amount that I am withholding for tax. So then I recalculate by adding this additional $989 into withdrawal, and then my taxes go up again. How do I calculate what the true withdrawal should be so that we net what we need for our annual expenses? Many thanks to you and Chris for your podcast. I find it to be the most informative and love that it isn't a show about pushing your sales or services. Because of that, it is obvious you're truly in it to help people. Well, I'll answer that last sentence. Thank you, listener. We do appreciate that. I'm speaking for Chris and I, and I'm sure for Paul as well. We all do this. I do it because I love it. I love doing this. Chris does it because he won't admit it, folks, but he loves it too. And Paul, I think you just kind of wanted to give it a shot. So yeah. I think we all appreciate it, and we're glad that you appreciate what we're trying to do. And I know what the problem here is, Paul, but I'm going to let you answer it because I think you're going to have to burst this woman's bubble on what happens when you send money to the IRS from a IRA.
Yeah, so I think the key for this is for that person to look at it as if she wasn't sending any money to the IRS. So if instead of having the IRA custodian take the money out and send it to the IRS, she's actually taking money out. So if she takes $100,000 out without worrying about taxes and she's going to be taxed on that, she is going to owe that $8,000 in taxes. The custodian transferring the taxes to the IRS, that's still her money. I mean, that's her money. She had to take that money out of the IRA, had to take that $8,000 out of the IRA. The custodian, for her benefit, went ahead and transferred that money over to the IRS. But essentially, that's what's happening. Now, as far as calculating it, how she's doing it, where she's putting into a tax calculator because it's taking advantage of the 10% bracket and the 12% bracket and her standard deduction and all the other items. It is sort of a circular function where you are sort of chasing your tail. If, in fact, you know that you're in a 12% bracket or 24% bracket, you sort of take 1 minus the percentage. So if it's 1 minus 12, it's 88%. You take what you need. So if it's 100,000 divided by 0.88, that's going to tell you approximately, it's not going to be exact, but it's going to be approximately how much money you have to take out to cover the taxes and the amount that you want to live on. So that's sort of what's happening here. You're not being double taxed because that tax is for your benefit. You know, it's if you took the money out and then wrote a check to the IRS for your taxes. So that's what's happening. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that might feel like double taxation, but it's not. The dollars you put in there in the first place were never taxed. And for instance, when you're making money at a job and you owe taxes, you don't get a tax deduction for the taxes that you paid. You paid taxes on your gross income. So it's exactly the same situation. It just kind of feels different because of the way you're doing it with the withholding out of your IRA. But if you look at it kind of behind the curtain, it's exactly the same thing as if you had earned that money and money was sent into the IRS on your behalf. It's net the same. Calm your concerns, if I can, you're not really being double taxed.
Yeah. And again, that calculation with the tax estimator, you're never going to get a precise numerical formula that you can bring it into that precise number, but you can come pretty close.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, that's all I wanted to cue in, and I think she understands now, and I think all our listeners understand. The mere fact that you have the custodian send the taxes directly to the IRS from your IRA does not exempt that distribution from taxes itself.
Right.
Because that would be just a massive loophole. If you took money out directly from your IRA and paid quarterly taxes on it yourself, that would be taxed. But if you sent it directly from the IRA to the IRS, you don't think it should be taxed? No, doesn't work that way. So you're not making a mistake. You're not being double taxed. It's just, it is what it is. That's why I call IRAs, folks, always taxable accounts, because the distributions are always taxable, whether you receive them or whether your custodian sends them on in your favor. You will pay taxes unless your custodian sends them to a charity and you're over the age of 70 and a half. Then you could treat that distribution as a QCD and owe no taxes on it.
Good point.
Okay, and we don't want to get deep into that right now, but just wanted to throw that in. All right, okay. I think you did good, Paul. You ready for another?
I am ready.
All righty. This one did not give a hint, so Chris, you are off the hook.
Oh, phew. Nice.
Okay, it says, Dear Jim, Chris, and Tax Team. So that would be the taxateers, folks, if you want to be technical. They are the three taxateers. Thank you for considering this question for your upcoming show with your CPA. And I will say, Paul, you've read through this question. I think this is going to be kind of a more art than science answer. So kind of pay attention, Chris, because I think you'll see where we're going with this. How do you consult your clients who are in the 32 or higher bracket to consider Roth conversions in their pre-retirement years? So we have obviously a high income earner right now, not retired, wondering how they should view Roth conversions. He continues, our accountant encourages us to put as much into our tax-deferred 401k rather than our Roth 401k. As a result, my husband is not open to the idea at all of completing smaller Roth conversions over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, since we're in the 32% bracket. I am not subscribed to the short-term view. I believe making annual Roth conversions over the next 6 years until he retires at 67 would be well worth paying the tax now, even at the 32 bracket. By waiting to begin Roth conversions until he retires at 67, I am under the impression we will run the risk of, first, Irma surcharges, something we're not experiencing now, taxable Social Security benefits, and sadly, I think this is an aside, folks. I think most of our listeners will pay taxes on their Social Security. And paying tax on Roth conversion within the tax bracket we can be assured is at, but might be greater than the bracket we're currently in. Do you think my assumption is correct? We are, this is their tax ordering number, Chris. We are tax planning for the two. So what they mean by that, folks, is again, my concept, who are we tax planning for? Two of you as a couple, one of you as a widow-widower, or none of you as an inheritance to a human beneficiary. If it's going to a charity, they're going to get it tax-free anyway, so you wouldn't necessarily prioritize them on the tax ordering number. But 210 sounds to me like they're prioritizing, by her own admission, though, the two. So it's an interesting twist to her situation. Currently, our combined income is $385,000. We have $1.7 million in assets and no pension. Now, Chris, maybe you, if you have a calculator, can break the dollar amounts up here, but she says of that $1.7 million, 68% is in always taxable accounts, 21% in never taxable accounts, and 10% in maybe taxable accounts. So she has some tax diversification, folks. Then she ends this with, we did not have the advantage of time to build up our Roth IRA or our Roth 401ks as much as we liked. Thank you for all your help you provide your listeners. And she gives her name, but we will call her Georgette. All right, I'm going to let you, Paul, and Chris answer this because it's kind of a planning question and a tax question.
Yeah, and you know, the way I look at it is, yes, they are in a 32% tax bracket currently, but with that volume or that amount of assets, I'm looking at it, Chris, is the tax deferred about $1.2 million roughly? Mm-hmm. Even with growth, you know, over the next, they'd have to be, what, age 75. It might double. You divide that by a divisor of maybe 20. You're still looking at roughly a couple hundred thousand of income, even from RMDs plus Social Security. They say they don't have a pension. They're not going to be in a 32% tax bracket at retirement based on current rules. You know, who knows what will happen in the future. So I'm a little bit agreeing a little bit with the CPA and the husband in that the tax rate that you're paying now is likely higher than the tax rate at retirement. Now, that's, again, we'd have to run some numbers and so on. The IRMA, I don't know if you're going to get up to an IRMA because married couple right now is what, about $200,000, Chris, for mm-hmm. the first IRMA bracket. That's mm-hmm. indexed inflation, essentially. It should grow to maybe $250,000, $300,000. I think even if you do hit that IRMA bracket, it's likely only going to be the first IRMA bracket. You're not going to be up to the top or even close to the top IRMA bracket. So I don't think it's a slam dunk that you want to do Roth conversions now based on those balances, but I'm certainly going to turn it over to Chris to tell me where I'm wrong. See, I'm ready to be wrong already.
No, I don't think it's necessarily wrong by any means. So I think she's looking at the right stuff, though, because it isn't just about the taxes and the assumed tax rate. There's all these kind of hidden taxes, if you will. And that's what IRMA is, the income-related monthly adjustment amount for Medicare, is effectively a tax. It's you're paying a charge for something due to your income that you otherwise would not pay. In my world, that's a tax. So she's looking at that. Now, her comment about Social Security, I don't think there's any conceivable way that they're not going to face taxability of the Social Security. So that's probably one thing they can just assume is going to happen no matter what they do. I wouldn't focus too much on that piece. But true, some people might think, oh my gosh, if they're in the 32, there's no way Roth makes sense. I'll disagree with that. There can absolutely be times, but as I was kind of absorbing what Jim was reading as he went through, I was actually encouraged when he got to the breakdown of the always taxable, never taxable, maybe taxable, where they had, you know, over 20% already in Roth. I thought it was going to be like a lot of the really scary situations that we see regularly is 85 or 90% in traditional, always taxable, and no Roth balance at all. So I think they've already kind of moved the needle a fair amount. And there's not, while 1.2 million is a lot of money to most people, it's not an enormous amount in always taxable. And I think through some projections, and that's really what this is going to take. It's going to take not looking and guessing, but rather actually making some reasonable predictions of what income recognition they face moving forward, what brackets are likely to look like moving forward. You know, they are assumptions. We don't know what Congress is going to do. We have this deadline of the expiration of the Tax Cuts and Job Act looming here in the next, you know, less than 2 years now, the end of 2025. That's supposed to be over. Whether that gets extended in some way or modified, we don't know at this point. So there are unknowns. So you will be making certain assumptions on things. But I would say it's more than 50%. If I had to make a bet at this point, I think deferring is still going to make sense for them. They're going to have a from 67 to 75 under current rules.
The big tax window
to
there.
Make a decent tax window there where they can move the needle more while they're not making $385,000 a year. Yeah. So they're going to be able to put some work in there maybe. Now, at that point, the Tax Cuts and Job Act rates will be gone, but that doesn't mean, you know, we're just going back to kind of the 2017-ish style rate breakdown. I think they'll still have an opportunity to do some work there. But I can't, what my brain can't quite do yet is on the fly make these projections and then give you a definitive answer. I think you're looking at the right stuff. Make sure you anticipate and factor IRMA in is probably the big one in this case. And do some projections, which is going to take some specialized software or a specialized Excel spreadsheet, if you're of the engineering type of mind, to take a look at these things to see. But I would hazard a guess that deferring now, for the most part, if not completely, is going to make sense. But
And I think with a 1.2 million balance, I think that tax window is going to allow them to convert probably 50% or more at a 25% or less bracket.
Which is certainly lower than 32.
Right.
And we didn't mention, I don't think we had a state here, so we don't know if there's state income tax things. That's another variable that if you live in a state with income taxes at the state level, you'll have to consider that in your calculations. These are tough to do on your own unless you do this all the time and have the right software. So you probably need to seek someone out that specializes in looking at this and not just your current tax situation, but rather forecasted tax situation. And then maybe you'll have a little more support for either your approach, where doing some conversions makes sense, or maybe your CPA and husband's preference you'll see it in the numbers and it'll make you feel better.
Well, and that's a good point you brought up, Chris, because a lot of people, let's say that they live in California, which can be a high tax state, but they know in retirement they're going to move to Nevada, as an example. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're paying 10% to California now, but during that tax window, they're going to be in the 0% tax bracket. That's an extra 10% mm-hmm. that they don't have to pay now versus, or they would have to pay now versus not paying it right. later. So right. those are the variables that we just don't know from the email.
Right, right.
Yeah, I would say I would agree with everything both of you have said. I don't see the need here to do conversions now because they're prioritizing the two. She didn't say we're prioritizing the one or the zero. We've seen that before, Chris, especially if there's a special needs child or something like that. And they have to. They have to get the assets into tax-free holdings. Or the account balances in the IRA were substantially larger than the 1.2 or so million that they have in IRA and 401k assets. And the RMDs were going to push them into a bracket higher than what their current income taxes are. These are normal situations where we see people converting while they're still working. But in this particular case, I agree, even with your projections, Paul, of the growth of their IRA. Now, I would assume the husband for the next 6 years will continue maxing out his contributions to the Roth. She didn't mention that, but I'm guessing he is. She also didn't mention...
No, they're contributing to traditional, not Roth.
Excuse me, to the traditional 401k. But she didn't mention if he had the ability to put additional dollars in after tax. So I would agree to max out your pre-tax account. However, with the amount of income you're making, if your husband has the ability to can put additional dollars into his 401k with after-tax contributions, you might want to consider doing those. That's a possibility, especially to get them in on an after-tax basis. Well...
Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to help a lot.
Stand corrected on that. I'm not quite sure that that would help them in this situation.
No, it's going to make their RMDs bigger to manage, and they're going to be contributing them at their current tax rate. So that may or may not come up. But again, that's what a projection might
Unless they
might
can
reveal.
Do the mega Roth conversion, if the employer will allow them to put the after-tax in and then do that mega conversion strategy...
And she's also working too, so it isn't just him. They're both of them are working. So, yeah, you're right. Maybe they can do the mega Roth, which is still allowed,
but it would be at 32. So you just have to decide if it makes sense to do that at 32 or not.
But this is already after tax dollars, Chris.
Yeah, he's still talking maxing out the
deductible. If they're saving it instead of spending it, the question then becomes, should we save it just outside of retirement accounts or should we shove it in there where at least the growth could be Roth? Yeah,
if they're not spending it all, because they are bringing in $300,000+ a year, and one or both of them has the ability to do the mega Roth conversion, they may want to consider that. But I agree, if they don't have the ability to do that, to simply put after-tax dollars into the 401k isn't really going to help your tax situation at all. Right. In fact, it would more complicate it because of the need to file 8606 every year.
Right.
So anyways, I think they're on the right track. I tend to lean more to what the husband and the CPA are saying, but I also feel there are definitely times where we would have said the opposite. But they might want to look at the mega Roth conversion ability. All right. Let's go to the next question. Okay, it says, hello, Jim and Chris. I really enjoy your podcast. It is by far the best retirement show I have found. Well, thank you, listeners. I think Chris and I greatly appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yours is the only one that provides real, usable information that has truly helped me with my retirement planning. I'm from South Carolina, and here is my hint.
I'm going to guess.
I think I can guess that one, too.
Ha, 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 ha.
This happened last week, too. He gave me California.
I was on a roll. I was on I'm just reading away.
Are you kind of like the Anchorman where you'll read anything in front of you?
Apparently. Anyway. It's in front of me. Yeah, anyways, his state hint, folks. He's in the state. I'm in the state with the peachoid. What the hell's a peachoid? We know the answer is now South Carolina.
I think on their state flag they have like a peachoid. It looks like a peach, but I'm not sure either. I've been to South Carolina, but normally I hear peaches, I think of Georgia, but I know there's a lot of peaches grown in South Carolina.
Well, I'm glad you told us where it was from, because I would have no idea what a peachoid is.
The state? Not with a peachoid, with the peachoid.
Oh, it's not it's a tower, a water tower that looks like a peach.
Yeah. Okay, well.
So yeah. it looks.
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah, did you Google it?
Uh-huh. It's a big, it's in Gaffney, South Carolina. There's a huge.
So does it look like that big peach emoji, which people use as a butt? Does it look like a big butt
up
there? It
actually does, yes. You can Google it after the show. But yes, it looks like a giant peach butt on top of the pedestal, like you'd see in a small town, rural, a water tower. And it's painted even to look, I mean, it's very realistic looking, both looking like a butt and a peach.
Well, mm-hmm. I'm glad I read the answer before the question. Hmm. Okay, here's this question. It is my understanding that where a couple owns real estate jointly with rights of survivorship, the surviving spouse inherits the deceased partner's share, and the tax rule allows for half the deceased spouse's portion of the property value to step up to the fair market value at death. This would be the step up in basis. I believe you touched on this in a previous podcast, which got me to thinking about this. Before I read on, Paul, anything you want to add for clarity on that, or are we good to go?
Yeah, no, let's go ahead and talk about that briefly. So the person is correct. I'm not sure if it's George or Georgette. I can't remember. But in this situation, let's say husband and wife own property jointly, and let's pretend the husband passes away. His half would get either stepped up or stepped down. There are cases where the fair market value is less than the tax basis, so it would get stepped down. Now, that's true in basically 41, 42 states, including the District of Columbia. The other 9 states that are community property states, such as Washington, California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, and Wisconsin, those are the community property states. In that case, when the husband passes away, his half gets stepped up, but the wife's half also gets stepped up. In that case, 100% gets stepped up, and it's even more unique than that. Let's say that a husband and wife owns an LLC, and the husband owns 1%, and the wife owns 99% of that LLC, and it's taxed as a partnership. When the husband passes away, it's not just the 1% that gets stepped up, it's the 100% of that LLC gets stepped up in community property state, whereas in all other states, including South Carolina, just the 1% gets stepped up. So I just wanted to sort of understand how it's great to be in a community property state, at least for passing away. I mean, you're gone.
Great place.
Your heirs love it, but that is the benefit of the community property rules. And there is an arcane, if people are in a separate property state and they had joint property that they acquired before about 1977 and the person passes away, that is also a case where potentially you can get a full step up even though you live in a separate property state.
Hmm. That's a fun fact.
Which state was that, Paul, you said?
Which state was, that's for all separate property states. So all those non-community property states, if you actually own that property jointly and you acquired it before 1977 approximately, then in that case, you still had to own it. So that's now, almost 50 years ago. And if they were to sell it or the person would pass away, they'd get a step up. Now, some states, including Colorado, because I've just gone through this, as far as discussion with an attorney, you can actually have a community property trust if you come from a community property state into a separate property state, such as California or Colorado. You can actually set up what's called a community property trust, which maintains that community property status, even though you're in a separate property state.
Yeah, I knew you could do that. I didn't know you needed a trust. I thought as long as you kept the community property separate, and clearly identifiable, I knew you could it would carry over. I didn't know it had to go into it, because Pete used to talk about that all the time when he was on the podcast, the estate planning attorney.
I wouldn't say, I'd say if you can maintain that separateness, but the problem is as time goes by, stuff gets commingled, and that commingling can potentially mess you up. Whereas with the, I think with the community property trust, you're specifically identifying and saying from here on forward, all these assets and any assets that we now acquire are going to be community property.
Okay. And then I know when we, since we kind of went down this little rabbit hole, I jokingly call Alaska the why of the states. And what I mean by that is everybody knows the vowels, A, E, I, O, and U, but you should also remember and sometimes why. Alaska is one of those states where it's really up to you. You can have separate property or you can have community property.
Correct.
You kind of get to choose. So I always call Alaska the Y state. It's and sometimes Alaska on community property. Anyways, we don't want to go too deep into that. But so far, so good. Let's get to the meat and potatoes of her question. I'm 68 years old and retired. My wife and I were doing some estate planning and discussing some what-if scenarios. And the topic of this step up in basis and how to handle it came up. Our state, which we all know now is South Carolina, not a community property state and has a big butt as a water tower. We've already been through all that. Our state is not a community property state. However, our house is in both of our names and jointly owned. I understand that the house will get now a partial step up onto the deceased spouse's half. But I have questions on how that's done and how to establish the basis. At the time of death of the first spouse, how is the value established? And what kind of records would we need to keep? Are you required to get a formal appraisal? Or can you just take the price off of Zillow? Will there be any forms that we must fill out? And are they required to be submitted to the IRS, I guess, to document the basis? And if so, when? I guess I'm curious on how this works. I asked when because several years ago, my father passed away. My mom is still alive. At the time, my mother and I were going through with this, the attorney and accountant handling probate, neither of them mentioned getting a step up on the house and at all. And I am wondering if this is something that can be done now after the fact for my mother to still get the step up on their house that was jointly owned in case she needs to sell it in the future. Also, I understand that on brokerage accounts that are held as joint tenants, you can get a step up on the deceased spouse's half as well. I know on those accounts, I can get a day-to-death account value, but what do I need to document and possibly file with the IRS? And then he does say, by the way, my wife had a stroke 13 years ago, and she also has similar gymisms. So hang in there. Well, I want to wish your wife the best for being a stroke survivor. Everybody knows I am as well. And I want to point out to Chris that perhaps my gymisms is a fact that I had a stroke. Mm. And your constant picking on me is not appreciated.
Well, I'd like to point out to listeners that we have recorded evidence of gymisms predating the stroke incident. So while they may have gotten worse, they didn't start with the stroke in your case.
Mm.
So that's what opens you up to ridicule.
And I've listened to those episodes, so this is where I stand with Chris.
Well, I've got the proof. We've got an archive of all of it.
All right.
But anyway, I think Paul's walkthrough of how this works is going to clear things up for this person.
Well, there's a few rabbit holes that could go down this. Mm-hmm. So I'll try to take these sort of in order. So on step up, what happens is once a person passes away, there is in most situations, there is no formal form that is filed with the IRS. And why do I say in most situations? If you have a taxable estate, so you're over the lifetime exemption, which is currently $13.6 million, then yes, you have to file what's called a Form 706, and you're going to list that house. You're going to list all those assets, and you're going to put those values on there. And then you also have to report that value on a separate form to the IRS and to all the beneficiaries. But for most people, they're not filing that form. However, again, this is rabbit holes. However, they may be filing that form to elect portability. When you want to elect portability to port that unused exemption over to the surviving spouse, then you would list those values on that 706. Now, that 706 for portability is a less onerous document. You don't have to go through as much detail. However, and you can be off plus or minus $250,000 on valuations on a portability, but for income tax bases, you do need to be fairly accurate. So the question on like a house, do you need to get a formal appraisal? Probably not, but I'm not sure if I would just pick Zillow. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I'd be more inclined talk to maybe a couple of real estate agents. Hey, if you were to list this house, mm-hmm. what would you be listing that house for? Go ahead and get that documentation. Likely that's not going to cost you any money.
Yeah, I was thinking that exact same thing. I wouldn't, I'm not sure that Zillow has been up to what is expected in a legal support kind of a situation. But I think what is reasonable in these cases is a what's called a market value opinion or market value assessment done by a licensed real estate agent and maybe a couple. And most of those they do for you as just kind of a service, hoping that when the day comes you will go on to sell it, you'll contact them. So I'm not going to promise every real estate agent will do it for you at no cost. But many will, so that shouldn't be too burdensome to get one of these. And I think especially if you had two that were consistent, that would be all the support you would need in front of the IRS.
Yeah. Take the average of the two.
Yeah, exactly.
And then backing up, to go down a little bit of another rabbit hole. Let's say that you live in California, you own the house, you and your husband or you and your wife, your spouse bought it 40 years ago for $100,000. Now it's worth $3.5 million. And now let's pretend like it's not California because that's community property. We'd be okay, but a separate property state such as South Carolina. Well, in that case, then I probably would go to the effort of getting a formal appraisal because likely if you're going to sell that house, you're going to have a taxable gain because you're only going to get a step up on half of the basis. So let's say the house is worth $3 million. You're going to have $1.5 million from the person that passed away. You'll have $50,000 on your share if you didn't put any improvements in. So that's $1,550,000. You sold it for $3 million. You're going to have potentially a $500,000 gain exclusion. You're still taxed on $1 million. That's worth the $300 or $400 or $500 that you might have to pay for an appraisal. Now it's a little easier over on the stock side where you have publicly traded information. There you look at the date of death value, you take the high and the low, you take the average of the two, and that's your value. Now, some brokerage companies will do that for you automatically where it's a single person, where it's a husband and wife, where one gets a step up, half gets a step up, and the other doesn't. Typically, they're not going to do it in that situation. It just depends on the brokerage company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is much easier with publicly traded assets that you have a true observable market value on any given trading day. Unless you pass away on a weekend, and then things get a little bit more interesting in the calculation, which could be a rabbit hole on another day.
And I've seen where the differences can be highly material. I mean, I've looked at brokerage statements I'm looking at. I'm like, this doesn't look right. They passed away, let's say, on February 2nd, and they sold all the stocks on March 1st, and the brokerage account is showing a $350,000 gain. Well, I know that's wrong, you know, so then you have to look at it. Well, on March 1st, it was, you know, if you did the date of death value, the gain instead of being 300,000 is now 3,000. So it's worth taking a look at.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think in this particular case, a lot of her questions were, or his or her questions were, is there something proactively we need to do? And then the mother's house that happened a long time ago, that might be a little harder because someone may not have thought to assess the value of it on the day of death back then, but you might be able to get enough support for justifying counting that half step up.
Well, or especially with houses, it may not even be important because the $500,000 sure. exclusion. You know, if the house, if they paid $300,000 for the house and they're going to sell it for less than $800,000, the $500,000 exclusion, or if it's the $250,000 that's left because it's gone long enough, then, you know, we really don't care in that situation.
True. If you're going to fit under the exclusion that might be applicable, the $250,000 or the $500,000, then you wouldn't chase any of this information down. It's not,
but if you have a rental house where you've depreciated true. It down to a very low number, then yes, you definitely certainly on a valuable rental property, a sixplex or a tenplex or whatever it might be, farmland, buildings, et cetera, you probably want to get an appraisal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good idea.
So I would like to kind of run a little with this.
Okay. I'm shocked
on a. on a little rabbit hole mm-hmm. because of upstream gifting. Mm. And he specifically mentions the mom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can gift an asset to someone who may pass away before you in an effort to get a full step up and basis on your asset. So it's not going to work in every particular case, and it's not going to help your mom with her house unless she's going to gift it to someone who's going to die before her. But we don't want to overlook upstream gifting in the case of a married couple. I believe upstream gifting will work for a married couple as well. Let's just say one of you, because you're in a non-community property state, so you don't have double step up in basis. You don't get the full account value step up. As we already said, you get a 50%. But if one of the spouses, sadly, is diagnosed with something and their life expectancy is going to be just a few years, it is a strategy to consider, especially in your example, Paul, where you said, what if they bought a house for hundreds of thousands, but now it's worth millions?
Yep.
So what happens is you gift to the ill spouse the entire home. You just, it's no longer owned joint. It's owned in that spouse's name. I'm hoping Paul or Chris know in the case of a spouse how long they have to live for this to work. But let me just kind of describe this because my brain, remember folks, I suffered a stroke, but my brain's not remembering how many years you have to survive. You can't do this on a deathbed. That's too easy. But what a spouse can do, a husband and wife, or a husband, wife, it doesn't matter. What a spouse can do is gift the other spouse their asset, the entire ownership in the house. Now the ill spouse owns it outright. At the death of that spouse, assuming they live X number of years, and I'm hoping Paul or Chris know that X, they leave it back to the original spouse or the surviving spouse at their death. And now there's a full step up in basis because 100% of it is owned by the spouse that's ready to has passed away. So there's no 50% step up, there's a 100% step up. Now you can also do this strategy with trusts. And I believe doing it through the trusts helps get rid of the hold period that you have to do because there's a power of appointment clause built into the trust. That gets way deep, and maybe when we start getting an estate planning attorney on, we'll talk about that strategy. But it is a strategy for this person or anybody listening to consider if there is a sizable gain. It's when you gave your example, Paul, of buying a house for hundreds of thousands, but now it's worth millions. There's a massive gain there that you can get 100% tax-free with some planning. Do either of you know, in the case of a spouse, how long they have to live?
You typically have to live at least a year and it's not a calendar year, it's a full year. Mm-hmm. So if the person happens to pass away within that year and the asset is coming back to the donor,
same person,
then they got to wait a year. But if that asset is going to somebody else, then
there's
the year period doesn't apply. Mm-hmm. Now, so you got
to
be
robbed my, yep.
Go ahead.
You rained on my thunder on that one, because where I was going to go with that is there's yet a way around that as well, folks. In the case of this couple again from South Carolina, and what if the spouse isn't expected to live a year now? And you might be thinking, gee, there's no way to get a double step up in basis. Yes, there is. The husband, let's say the wife is the one who's going to pass, the husband still gifts it to the wife. The wife names the son, assuming they have a son, to inherit the home. Now the son has it and gets the full 100% step up in basis. The wait, that 1 year wait, is only if the same person who gifted it to the person who's dying is the one who receives it back. And that's right. Where this trust with a power of appointment clause built into it can help avoid some of that. But outside of that, you simply name a child or someone else trustworthy to inherit the home. Now, since most people have a $12+ million estate tax exemption, and most people are never going to have an individual estate worth nearly that much, the son could turn around after inheriting that home, could sell it, get all the cash, and just gift that cash back to the father. Mm-hmm. So it is a way to get the money back to the person who needs it. Or maybe the father would say, hey, you keep some, give me some. But because the estate tax exemptions are so high, it's not going to become an issue with estate taxes. But that's another way to get a full step up in basis on an asset that has greatly, greatly appreciated. Again, it's a sad situation because you're dealing with the death of someone. So we sound a little bit heartless right now. But if somebody is handed that horrendous news that you have a limited life expectancy, it's some of the tax planning strategies that can be done. Mm-hmm. Anything either of you want to add to some of this?
I would add one caution, I guess, is remember, once you've gifted that asset to that person, you've lost control mm-hmm. of that asset. You want to make sure family dynamics are in very good shape. You know, what you don't want to do is give this to somebody and instead of them passing, well, this would be good, I guess, instead of passing away within a year, they last another 5 or 10 years and then they get divorced. And that asset mm-hmm. goes outside of the family. I've seen that in some situations where, yeah, this sounded like a great idea. And then the reality was that it ended up not being a good idea. But I think in this case where you're talking, hey, we're fairly certain that, you know, within a year or two, this is going to happen. You have good family dynamics. There's no drawback to it.
Yeah. If it doesn't work, it kind of just goes back to the status quo.
Yeah.
So if it ended up coming back in this case, because they didn't live a year, you didn't use the technique that you described, giving it to someone else, the original basis just remains. So there's not a lot of downside to it as long as there's not a risk of something happening to the asset after you've gifted it to the person, which I always worry about Medicaid clawbacks and things like that could happen. So you have to be sure that none of that is a threat before you start pulling off a maneuver like this.
And also they have to remember that if you're gifting it between husband and wife, you don't have to file a gift tax return. But if it's gifting it, let's say, to a son, to a parent, then that mm-hmm. son has to file a gift tax return. And that does eat into their lifetime exemption. So that is something to be cognizant of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And that's why, I mean, I made clear to mention that we have a fairly high exemption, which is scheduled to drop to around $8 million adjusted for inflation, still a very high amount. So again, you don't act on anything from this podcast or any podcast because you heard someone talking about it. It's to give you food for thought, folks, and start talking to professionals to put something like this in place. But if they've clearly, as a couple, are talking about trying to get a step up in basis, and how do we do it? A strategy to get the full step up in basis is upstream gift. It's what the nickname is, upstream gifting. And it can be done. And if the spouse is going to pass very, very soon, and there's not enough time to wait that year, if you have a child, again, and the child is trustworthy, not going through a divorce, not being sued, just is totally on board with the whole strategy, it's another way, again, gift it to the person who's going to pass. That person names it to a different person at their death, in this case, the child. The child can then sell the house tax-free because of a step-up in basis, and then gifts the money back to the surviving parent, all tax-free.
Or you could name your friendly podcast host here, hosting person.
You could do that, absolutely. But, you know, that's totally up to the people. Okay. So I think that was a good question. I think that worked out. We covered a few things on it. Do we have time for more questions? I don't know what
we've got time for. One more, I think.
One more. Okay. So let me look to see which one I want to do. I don't know if it really matters. Let me try this one. Or this one. I'm looking, folks. I'm looking for the one that's going to be quicker and easier to read. All right. We'll do the one. I know you have them, Paul. Do you like the one with the special needs trust? Is that one look like a good one for you?
I think we can do that one, although it's going to be, again, a little bit more of an art than a science-type question, but that's good.
Okay. All right, so this one, no hint, but he does say his state. See if I can think of a hint for the state. I'll just give, remember we did that word association? I said one word and then you had to try to guess it before, Chris?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can I give three words this time?
Sure. It's your game, okay. So.
My game. You will guess this. There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, we're going to make Paul try first.
Paul sees the answer. Oh, he has this question.
Fine. Okay. Lay it on me.
Lay it on you. Okay, three words. Everybody listening to this should be able to get, if you don't guess this state, something wrong with you. You were sleeping in history class. Fountain of youth.
Hmm. Florida.
Florida, exactly. Okay.
Who was searching for the fountain of youth famously?
Do you know who it was?
I'm asking you.
Ponce de Leon.
Really? Could you say that one more time?
No. I just said it. Hi, Jim and Chris. I have been trying to find a good answer to this question. And when you said you were taking questions regarding taxes, I thought to myself, my chance. Here is my situation. I'm retired military and have a 26-year-old disabled son with Down syndrome. He is currently living in a group home and receiving SSI and Medicaid, which pays for his living needs and some medical. As you know, his income to stay eligible for Social Security and Medicaid benefits is limited to assets of $2,000 or less. When I retired from active military service in 2005, I elected survivor benefits for my son, as I know he will be disabled permanently. But a few years ago, we did estate planning with my lawyer and set up a will and a special needs trust, which will be created at my death. And this trust will receive my survivor benefits, currently about $3,035 a month. And I believe military pensions, Chris, have COLA adjustments, right? So it would rise?
Generally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Either my wife or my son would be the trustee who will administer the account. But in hearing you and others talk about the high taxes associated with these trusts, even for relatively small balances, Do you have any recommendations on how I might be able to prevent a large portion of this survivor pension that's going to my disabled son from being taxed? I have asked my estate planning attorney about this, but she's not familiar enough with taxes and could not help. It seems to me that, similar to my current monthly military pension, this is going to be viewed as income to my son and subject to high trust tax rates. Any thoughts would be greatly appreciated. Let me start with this, and then I'll let Paul and Chris opine as well, because Paul's kind of right. This is more of an art than a science. But let's bring everybody up to date. If you're a longtime podcast listener, you know Chris and I are not a huge fan of trusts being beneficiaries of IRAs. Now, this isn't an IRA, but the reasoning holds the same. Because trusts pay compressed trust tax rates. You will hit the, and remember, this person's in Florida, so there's no state income tax issues, but there's federal income tax issues. And a trust, when it receives income, will generally pay the highest marginal rate in existence at the time the trust receives it. Right now, that's 37%. Next year, or at the end of next year, January 2026, unless Congress acts and changes things in 2025, that will revert to 39.7, Paul, is that it? 39.6. 39.6. Call it 40%, folks. Who knows what the future is going to be? Maybe when this gentleman passes away, the highest marginal rate is 65%, 55%, 53%. Who knows? Nobody. But when a trust receives income, not just any asset, life insurance, Roth money, step up in basis assets, all of those could be received by the special needs trust and no taxes are owed. But when income is received by the trust, taxes will be owed at these compressed rates. That's why we don't like IRAs as beneficiaries of, trusts as beneficiaries of IRAs. Because IRA money is always taxable, and it's always taxable as income. Now, a few things to understand. A trust that acts as a conduit simply takes the money, turns around, and passes it out. That's a conduit trust. Those trusts generally are not subject to the high trust tax rates. Why? Any income passed out of a trust to the beneficiary will be taxed to the beneficiary in the income that it was subject to. I know I'm not explaining that right. Paul can clarify. But if it's income, regular income, income tax income, and is passed out, it'll be taxed as income. If it's a cap gain being passed out, it'll be taxed as a cap gain to the beneficiary. If it's basis, subject to no taxes, it can be received by the beneficiary, subject to no taxes. So the tax qualification will follow it right through the trust. Now, in this particular situation, a special needs trust by design cannot be a conduit. Why is that? Well, as this gentleman pointed out, his son is getting assistance from the government, from Social Security and Medicaid. Those are means-tested benefits. If a child, a special needs child, a special needs person who is receiving those benefits is also receiving income, the government's going to say, well, wait a minute, this income exceeds the means testing. You're going to lose this government benefit. So the government sanctions special needs trust. It's not a loophole. If you create a special needs trust and have certain rules and regulations and wording in the trust document, and you have a trustee, I'm going to caution this listener. I hope when you said my son's going to be trustee, you're not going to put your Down syndrome son as trustee of his trust. I wouldn't even put the wife as trustee of a special needs trust. Special needs trust has to do things right. And there are corporate trustees who specialize, no pun intended, being the trustee of special needs trusts. That's who you should be naming. You don't want the trustee to screw up because they're not experts in trusts. They're not following maybe tax law changes or law changes in general in regard to special needs people and disabled people. And they make a stupid mistake that costs your son his government benefits. So I do want to go down that rabbit hole as well and encourage you to really think who you're going to name as trustee of this trust, because they got to know the you-know-what from their elbow and do things right. It's not something you should tread into lightly, being trustee of a special needs trust. Okay, back to what I was getting at, folks. So a special needs trust by design is not that conduit. It has to hold the money because the trustee can only release the money to cover certain expenses that will not impact the child's ability to get government benefits. So it has to accumulate. And the trustee, as I said, who needs to know what they're doing, the trustee distributes money correctly. So not all the money every year will be distributed. Because he's putting a pension, he's going to fund the special needs trust with a pension payment, which is fully taxable as income. And he's getting $3,000 a month right now. That's $36,000 a year in today's dollars. That means half of it about is going to be taxed at 37%. So he's going to be losing quite a bit of, or the son is going to be losing quite a bit of money to taxes. But that's why the trust has to accumulate these dollars. And because the trust is not receiving Roth IRA assets or non-IRA assets that got a full step up in basis at the death, so it's received tax-free, or life insurance proceeds, because it's receiving income, a good deal of those dollars will be lost. And if income taxes go up, even if they pass, you know, against the evil rich, and they say, hey, we're going to make a new high bracket, and that's going to be 65%, but only the evil rich, only people who make more than $1 million in income are going to pay that. So don't worry, none of you other people have to worry about it. Oh, we'd all be out there with our pitchforks screaming, yeah, yeah, stick it to the rich, yeah, yeah. Well, now that trust could lose 65% because that's the new highest marginal bracket, assuming the government doesn't make an exemption for trusts, which I doubt they would, because then it'll be a massive loophole for the evil rich that they're trying to barbecue. So you got to watch out for this. And I'm going to turn this over to Chris and Paul as well. I'm not going to hog this answer. But what's running through my mind, folks and listeners and Paul and Chris, is, gee, if you don't need all of this money, I don't know if you can change the beneficiary on your pension to someone else. I don't know. So I am a little concerned. But if there was a possibility, if you have the cash flow to start looking at a life insurance policy and using your pension benefit to help pay the life insurance premiums to leave your special needs son $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million, whatever you can afford based on your free cash flow and your health, that would be a better asset. Or using some of your money to pay for Roth conversions. You don't give us any hint about any type of accounts you have. Do you have the ability to start converting? In other words, in your tax ordering number of 210, prioritize the zero. 021 or 012, and start trying to do some conversions. What you need to be able to do is start finding a better asset to leave to the special needs trust. But I don't know, Chris, if he'll be able to change his beneficiary from his son. And if his son is going to be the beneficiary and he can't change it, he needs to leave it to a trust or it's going to screw his son from day one. And then the cost of this is going to be the compressed trust tax rates. Okay, anything you two want to say?
Well, when you said you're not going to hog up the whole answer, I think you were kind of admitting what you actually just did. So just let's put that out there. The one thing I would add is this situation begs an estate planning attorney with deep tax knowledge, which they do not have currently by their what you read. They, an estate planning attorney that also focuses heavily on taxes would probably be able to come up with a little bit to move the needle because I don't think they're going to be able to change the beneficiary.
Isn't that LLM, Chris? You got to look for that after their name.
That's typically what tax attorneys have is LLMs, but doesn't have to be. But
So it's someone who's very specialized in special needs trusts and taxes. Yeah. That combo, which is out there. Those do exist. That's the dual specialization I think that this person needs to look for. Anything we suggest are just ideas, but someone who can really dig into the nuances of this situation and look for an opportunity to prevent this heavy cost for using the special needs trust. Because you pointed it out that if they accumulate income inside the special needs trust, to use the trust as intended, the cost is huge in the form of those extra taxes. There might be ways to adjust this. I liked, before you said it at the end, I was going to propose investigating life insurance as an alternative funding mechanism for the special needs trust.
Another asset could be their house.
Right.
Their house could be put into the trust. It's got a step up in basis. It's completely tax-free. Mm-hmm. They can invest it in, dividend paying stocks or whatever and no capital gains until they sell it. So, I think there's several options. I think Chris and Jim, you know more about special needs trusts than I do, but can you have a special needs trust that allows the trustee to sprinkle income to the non-disabled child?
God, I don't know off the top of my head if you can have a dual beneficiary wrapped up in there.
I don't believe you can. I'm not 100% certain on that. We're certainly not attorneys.
Yeah.
But
because if you can sprinkle income, you can push the income out to the non-child.
I know if it's a AMBT special needs trust, which was created under Secure 2, the applicable multi-beneficiary trust, no other beneficiary can receive the income payments. It has to be after the death of the special needs child.
Yeah.
So I'm 99% sure on that. I'm not 100% sure. Yeah. This is why, again, Chris and I know more than most, but certainly not at the level of a estate planning attorney who specializes, no pun intended, in special needs trusts. So I'm cautious to answer that outright, Paul, but I don't believe the special needs trust can also go to other beneficiaries. But if it could, is the trustee allowed to choose or does it have to be prorated amongst all beneficiaries? Can they pick and choose a beneficiary?
That's why I use the word sprinkle. Trust allows you to sprinkle income to whoever you want to.
As the trustee. Yeah. But I don't think I've ever heard of that in a special needs trust, but it's certainly could be out there. And that's, again, supporting what I think would recommend highly to this person. You've got to go to a specialist in this and your current attorney, if they're not deep enough on the tax side, that's why you're not getting the answers I think you're looking for.
And naming this pension, your hands are tied.
I mean,
you got 36 plus thousand coming in every year that's going to be taxable. You can't do anything about that. Yeah. And if you do kick it out to the kid, he's going to end up not getting state aid anymore or federal aid. So I agree with Chris. So
yeah, my thing that I would add, they say my estate planning lawyer, estate planning attorney, is not familiar enough with taxes to be able to help. If you went to an estate planning attorney and they just kind of threw the special needs trust together for you, and that's fine. And the attorney probably knows more than all three of us on this podcast. I'm not disputing that. But if they don't specialize in special needs planning, because I was a little bit surprised he wrote that, because to me, Any attorney who specializes in special needs trusts will, in my opinion, by default, you can't specialize in something and ignore the 800-pound gorilla
taxes,
in the room.
Right.
Taxes.
Yep. I think they could try, and there's some
so
that
to ignore
that
it makes me scratch my head saying, maybe you truly do need to go to an attorney who does specialize in special needs trusts, because they, it would be like Chris and I trying to do a podcast called the Retirement and IRA Show and not talking about taxes at all. Well, we're talking about IRAs and retirement, but no, we don't know enough about taxes to feel comfortable talking to you about it. Taxes play a massive role in IRAs and retirement. Well, taxes play a massive role in special needs trusts because they're all discretionary accumulation style trusts. They're not conduit trusts. So I would really encourage you to go to another attorney by an hour of their time. Your current attorney should not be offended by that. But go to an attorney who specializes in special needs trust or special needs planning. And it would be great if they had the LLM or something like, I think it's L period LM. I don't know. Pete had that. And Pete, who used to be on the podcast, was very knowledgeable in taxes as well. That's the designation you're looking for. And that attorney might be able to come up with some ideas. And maybe you also need to find out, can you change the beneficiary on that military pension? Because if you can't, and it's going to go to your son, it needs to go into a special needs trust, and you need to acknowledge you're going to lose a lot of those dollars. But that doesn't preclude you from trying to fund that trust with other dollars as well, right, through life insurance, Roth conversions, step up in basis assets, anything like that. Just keep your IRAs and 401ks out of that special needs trust as well, or you're only going to muddy the waters even more.
Yep. Yep. Okay.
Okay.
Well, we'll have to wrap at that point. So we do appreciate people sending in these tax questions so that we could pester Paul today, and we'll have him on future shows as well. If you want to send in your own questions for the Q&A show, just email them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. And the subject line indicates that it's a question for the podcast. If you put a basic topic comment in the subject line, that helps Jim sort them out. So that's a little thing we've added recently as a request. But I think we're going to try to have Paul on for an EDU show next week. So we'll know that when Tuesday rolls around. But yeah, thanks both Jim and Paul.
Thank you.
Yeah. And everyone else, we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.